Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Alright, I'm about to go back to
yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cup. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that down. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wait.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Yeah. Fuck the feds. 800 G's cash on the bedspread. Fucking plug when left, now a fed Zed. Dirty business on the low with cartel locos. On the yacht floating off the coast of Acapulco. Senoritas on the deck with their ass out. Hoes always be around when you cash out. The black mass boys, bullies with the fullies hit another lick. Cash bundles in 100 bricks. Everybody's fucking dirty in the gutter, brother. Double cross you, triple cross you, they'll set up they mother. Next stop, recop down in Sinaloa. Dirt cheap, but you gotta get across the border. Cops banging for they take, cause they lie too. Pay them double, let them cocksuckers drive it through. Back in Cali, trap house with the view. $11 million beach house up in Malibu.
The hustle don't stop, unload, recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them feds in my rear view. The hustle don't stop, unload, recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them feds in my rear view.
Gotta call my man, died, thought somebody shot him. Turns my nigga Tito fentanyl and Oxycontin. 100 packs, got the pressure for 100 racks. DHL to ATL, got 200 back. My old partner used to be the motherfucking dude. Fed served him when he started moving dog food. Private flight to Vegas, it's about 10 deep. My shit don't stink, bitches in designer mink. Everywhere we move, that's where the party go. Presidential suite up at the Bellagio. Hit the tables 1 a.m., let the cash blow. Win or lose, money's clean and we out the door. Couldn't club, dress code, said no strap or vest. Fuck the club, all them hoes on crystal meth. Another phone call, move 10,000 tabs of X. Another hour and my bitch is coming out that dress.
The hustle don't stop, unload, recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them feds in my rear view. The hustle don't stop, unload, recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them feds in my rear view.
Helicoptered off the roof to the Gulf Stream. Met some players in Miami with the triple beam. Said they got the white raw straight from Bogota. Niggas had the illest Bugatti that I ever saw. Insane, crazy crib out on Key Biscayne. Hard body pulled up to it on a seaplane. Cowboys, bad news, plenty of jewels. Speedboat, bad bitches, infinity pools. Had my nigga Fetty with me, he draping Versace. From the Jex gangbanger with a gang of bodies. A mil cash in his Gucci like the shit was legal. 12-inch suppressor screwed onto his Desert Eagle. Met a chica at the crib, a fucking narco queen. Her uncles were the biggest bosses out of Medellin. You could feel the bitch was cold, home, she was nothing soft. Fuck around with her and get your fucking dick cut off. Me and Fetty hit the jet back to Cali. Private so fat, could've had a bowling alley. Wheels touchdown, smooth on the tarmac. G650, true to Maybach. I got at least half a mil tied in legal fees. Another half, bailing out my little G's. DA's on my bumper, I can feel the squeeze. Till they kill me, I'm a psychopath about this cheese.
The hustle don't stop, unload and recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them fans in my rear view. The hustle don't stop, unload and recop. More cars, more jewels, fuck it if a body drop. More bitches, more cash, fuck you. Motherfuck, got them fans in my rear view.
All right, we are episode 526 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin, and this show is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Fleetwood and the Cock Pickers, Jesse Petit, Core Financial, Da Vinci Clothing. I got my host, T-Max, with the facts on the line. What's good, brother?
Man, God bless, man, to everybody. It is Off the Cuff Radio, the flyest radio show on the freshest frequency on internet waves. I am the co-pilot, T-Max, with the facts. Of course, you have your head coach, King Eric the Ruler. Shout out to our co-hosts, Sandman, Lady Chinchilla. And tonight, ladies and gentlemen, once I know I said it before, time and again, but in a long line of legendary, great shows, we have another entry in the long line of great legendary shows. This guest right here, I don't think words can appropriately give acknowledgement to all of this man's awesome achievements in authoring. This man has written for Vibe. He has written for Rolling Stone. He has written for Men's Journal, Blender, The Guardian, Billboard, and The New York Times. And the song sets it off right in terms of the true crime narratives that he has penned, writing about El Chapo, writing about the Franklin Avenue posse, writing about Forrest Nathfield. And, of course, the longest-running male actor lead in the history of television series, shout-out to Ice-T. Coming from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, this man, to call him legendary is not doing him enough justice. With his wisdom, wit, academia, he is indeed worth a century with his name keeping it 100 in the legacy of literature that this man has penned. And, of course, we can't forget he is the 2020 Christopher Award winner. We are honored. We are privileged. We are so humbled. Ladies and gentlemen, the extraordinarily excellent Douglas Century, welcome to Off the Cuff Radio.
What's good, my man?
Well, welcome, guys. What's good? Can you guys hear me okay? I'm on my little Beats by Dre, you know, Bluetooth. I could switch it up to a physical mic if we needed, but if it's clear.
No, we can hear you.
How
just
does
fine.
It sound?
Well, no, we're good.
We hear okay. You. We're good. You're good.
Perfect, man. You just gassed me up beyond what, you know, my mother or anybody would say. Shit, man. That was beyond. Like, I'm listening to that going, is that me? Holy fuck. I don't know.
Doug, your credentials are a who's who, is an all-star of authoring awesomeness. I mean, we had to do
crazy
some study in it. We
man.
Were like, man.
Well, I mean, listen, I looked at some of your past shows. Wendy Day, I mean, I was in New York. You know, you're right to say I was born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I'm coming to you from out Canada right now, but I've been living in New York for 30 years, and I was there in what is now considered such the glory days, you know, from 88 onward. So I remember meeting Wendy Day, and she's this woman was trying to keep young artists from getting jerked out of their, you know, royalties, their publishing and all that shit. So, I mean, you've got some great guests on your show, so I want to beat you guys up for, and also be really appreciative for having me in the company of somebody like Wendy Day, who really was a groundbreaking figure in trying to educate young artists who were just hungry for that paycheck that, no, you got to own your publishing. You got to, you know. So I was there for that era, like 92, 93, 94, 95, all that stuff was happening. And it was pretty mind-blowing to me that it's nowadays considered legendary because it was just some shit that I was doing, you know, like hanging out with Wu-Tang and all those guys. Like, it was just part of life back then, man.
Man, I mean, look, I mean, shout out to Wendy Day at the Rap Coalition. We had her on about a month ago. The history, the game that woman gave us in terms of her crusade, her passion, her action, putting the passion in.
Yep.
You know, when you look at what she has accomplished in reference to how she has helped out so many artists in terms of giving them the help that they needed but didn't have an outlet to at the time. I mean, she's just as much of a legend in the game as you are. One thing about
it, she did a lot of practical. She did a lot of practical stuff. You know, you got to understand that nowadays, I was explaining to somebody last night, you know, there's not much money in actually making a record anymore. Artists make their money off merchandising and touring, right? But back in the days, like, you know, all these indie labels, Tommy Boy and Nervous Records, and guys would just be, you know, handed a budget. And they didn't realize that, you know, their studio time was recoupable. This is like, you know, reel to reel. Back in the days, you know, 24 track, 48 track. Now everybody's making their own beats at home and the game has changed. But you're a hungry young guy from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, you know, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, the Bronx. Some executive says, here's $200,000. That's more money than you've ever imagined you could ever see in your life. But you don't realize that's going to $50 an hour recording studio time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So she had to educate these guys with stars in their eyes when they saw a check that size. No, that's not a good deal, son. Like, that's not a good deal. You know, you're getting jerked. But, so she really was there in the mid-90s to try to help a lot of these young guys, you know, fight for their rights, which was fight for their publishing, fight for the control of their masters, and all the stuff that, you know, Jay-Z has made a big deal of kind of publicizing for a younger generation. But back in the, man, you know, Melody Mel, all these guys, you know, DJ academics can say they're salty. They're not salty. They just got jerked. They didn't. They didn't really make money off the stuff that they created. Kool Herc, these guys didn't get paid the way that they should have been. And thankfully, we got a couple billionaires, you know, at least 50 Cent and Dr. Dre, and I heard Puffy's a billionaire today, supposedly. So, you know, now guys are actually making the kind of money they should have made from back in the 70s, right? So Wendy was part of that much more than me. I was there documenting it, and she was there helping people.
Well, it goes hand in hand, because one doesn't work without the other, because the work is one thing, but to have somebody... And this is what, in terms of journalism, why it is so important, what, you know, all three of us, you and King especially, Doug, have a real kinship because, you know, King was a journalist. You know, that's where he really started before, you know, Off the Cuff, you know, became, you know, what it is today. So you and him have a very intimate understanding of the written word. Myself, shout out to my mother birthing me with the genes of appreciation for all things literature. She would read to me in her womb. I developed a love for it and a passion for, you know, reading the written word and compositions myself. You know, shameless publicity once again, as I always do on many a show. I have every Source magazine since 1994, every Double XL since 1997.
We're talking about that, man. Like, you know, people don't, you know, younger people don't understand what it was. The fresh issue of Source hits the stands. Who's in the unsigned hype? I mean, Biggie. Like, I remember seeing the unsigned hype column made or break, was the make or break for a lot of guys' careers. And
it was.
It really was. Like, and five stars? Sorry, it's not five stars. It was five mics back in the day, right?
Yeah,
five mics. You know, this was like, I don't think the younger generation can appreciate the power and influence that the written word of, not so much Vibe, because Vibe was a little more pop trendy, but the Source, There was a couple others, like, wasn't it Rap Pages? There were a couple of
Rap Pages, Murder Dolls,
with,
all of that, yeah.
Right. And they really made artists. And the executives and everybody was checking for this stuff, and you really read it cover to cover. So, hey, man, the fact that you saved every issue, good on you, dog.
Yeah,
man.
Well, also, too, I keep them under lock and key because, Doug, we got so much to get into, but we just need to keep rolling with this until we get on to where the conversation takes us.
And before I go in, man, I'm seeing some numbers calling a lot from the Virginia area, 757 number. If you have any phone calls or, you know, you want to leave a shout-out or ask questions, feel free to hit the line. Like, the line is 516-531-9596 and press 1.
Yeah, hit 1.
Oh, shout-out to Virginia, man. Like, Virginia, I mean, I was in New York in the 90s, and New York got, you know, we're the shit. Like, you know, then, you know, Snoop came up. But Virginia always brought... Wasn't it Teddy Riley? There was a whole bunch of sounds that were coming out of the VA area that, you know, you really contributed a lot to the 90s hip-hop sound, for sure.
Yeah.
And of course, the South in general. But, you know, New York loves to say, you know, we created it and all that stuff, and we did. New York really was the birthplace. But it spread far and wide, and every region has contributed to some degree. So shout-out to Virginia.
We appreciate that, you know what I'm saying? When you look at it, Doug, because when you think about publications today, and, you know, I keep all my magazines under lock and key, going on eBay to see how much some of those are worth now, and I'm like, we talked about this off air, and it's like, I mean, it's funny because when we look back at that time period, we see where hip-hop was in its nascent form.
Yep.
You could argue that it goes back even to the 60s with James Brown in terms of him and the JBs, you know, going into the 70s with The Last Poets, Gil Scott Heron. Even before its dated inauguration, August 11th, 1975-76, is when it was pretty much noted as being, matter of fact, 1972.
You're talking about Kool Herc's, you know, back to school.
Yeah.
The back to school jam with Kokla Rock and, you know, but I'm a bit of a cultural historian and sociologist, spent a lot of time in Jamaica. And if you listen to, you really get into the history of, like, the sound systems of Jamaica, which Kool Herc was representing that stuff, right, in the Bronx. You can find these guys, U-Roy, Dillinger, and they're chatting on the mic on a version, on an instrumental dub. They're chatting on the mic 72, 73. It's basically like, you know, out of sight, you know, rock on my mellow, all the, it's just shout out. They're not really trying to rhyme, but it all comes from the African tradition of spoken word that Muhammad Ali was kind of rhyming, you know, these guys were doing stuff, preachers do it. So to put a date on it, James Brown, exactly. And you go back and you go, you know, Cab Calloway, you know, where do you, at a certain point you go back to Africa, probably you go back to some, you know, Sierra Leone and Nigeria places, you probably got talking a certain way over a beat. But I mean, Jamaican music had a big, big, big impact. And, you know, having lived in New York, what's amazing is you go to a place like the Bronx and you got Jamaicans, you got Puerto Ricans, you got Dominicans, you got African Americans from the South, all living in the same housing project, all riding the same subways, which is, that's not the same in LA and Chicago. Neighborhoods are really segregated. So one of the things
they
I
are.
Think people need to understand, you know, people were giving Fat Joe some flack for dropping the N-word a lot. I said, man, have you ever been to New York? Because very light-skinned Puerto Ricans with blue eyes are called. Like, I mean, that's nothing new, dude. Fat Joe didn't just start, you know, dropping that word. Puerto Ricans have considered themselves part of black culture. I mean, the minute I got to New York, I noticed it. So, yeah, I didn't – somebody pulled my coat to the fact that there was a controversy to Fat Joe. Is Fat Joe, as a light-skinned, green-eyed or blue-eyed Puerto Rican, allowed to say that word? And I'm like – I mean, if you've ever been to New York, I have no Mexicans that say it now. I don't have a problem, you know, with another group feeling that they're entitled. As a white Jewish person, I don't feel cool saying it. Eminem has never said it in a rhyme, as far as I know. But
right,
when you're in New York, you realize very quickly one of the things that made hip hop happen was the influence of the Latinos. Like, and it's not just the Cold Crush, you know. The Rocksteady Crew. There were DJs. Like, it was the blend of all of it: the Caribbean influence, the Southern influence, the everything coming together to a point in the darkest, deepest bowels of the devil, as Ice-T would say, the bowels of the devil. And the South Bronx was a war zone. It was destroyed buildings. And out of this destruction came a new art form. And when I listen to Melly Mel or Coco Rock and guys talking, they weren't trying to be gangsters. They were just trying to entertain people. Because the real gangsters were there in the clubs with the 357 Magnums, like, yo, shut me up, motherfucker. Like, and if you don't, you're going to get a bullet in your head. Like, you know what I mean?
But that's what it was. King and myself, Doug, we always have a running joke on the show, but we're so respectful with
the old New York.
The old New York.
Yeah. Old New York. Exactly.
Yeah. But that's what it was.
But honestly, like, to have a little perspective, being born in Canada, I see how New York birthed it, and there were so many great artists out of New York. But then when we heard Atlanta come with its own sound, Houston come with its own sound, obviously L.A.,
mm-hmm.
you know, Miami, like, it's the whole United States. And now, I mean, arguably Canada has the biggest rapper, financially speaking or whatever, and The Weeknd beyond
285 million worth.
Exactly. I mean, it is a global phenomenon, right? And, you know, it's one of the things I've talked about with Ice, you know, if we're going to get into the whole, my relationship with Ice-T and working with him. You know, Ice was spitting what he called toasting, right? Toasting was pre-hip-hop. He was spitting what he called Crip rhymes. And it's big in the pimp culture. Like, just being able to rhyme on. And then he realized, man, it's a big deal to actually go into the studio and try to make that shit fit on the beat. Because that's not the same thing. It's actually just. But he was entertaining the Crips in, I think, 75, 76.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, I learned to rhyme basically to keep the gangbangers off my bumpers, right? Like, they would sweat me, and I would be like, okay, some of it was quotes from Iceberg Slim, but some of it was just him freestyling and making up shit about the set. And he didn't know about hip-hop in New York. So, I mean, the idea that New York created something, I think it existed in African-American culture and Caribbean culture, and it just needed a name, right? It needed something to coalesce into a... So, I mean, it's a deep thing in... I mean, if Ice-T was doing it with the gangbangers and they were entertained by it, you know that they had heard other people do it. I mean, I'm thinking it was more like the kind of pimp talk the guys, you know, pimps always rhyme, right? And they have these very clever ways of saying things. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I told me he was writing rhymes before they ever heard of New York, right?
Yeah.
So,
and you talked about that in your book. Ahead. We're going to get into that. Yeah, when you said, because there was one rhyme, you know, where I could detail it, and I have the book in my hand, and I'm reading where he would talk about the game from it. Now, this is a little bit after, you know, the high school as he progressed, but he wrote, I started the diagram licks with Matt, teaching motherfuckers that the getaway is 100 times more important than anything that happens during the lick itself. The game is forever evolving. And while the finessers were still trimming, some of us decided to bring out the sledgehammers. I rhyme about this in my song, That's How I'm Living. Dash for the jewels, baby, sledgehammers were the tools. I speak on this with hesitation, even though we passed the statute of limitations.
Yep.
You know, cold.
So this, now you're getting into what Ice was documenting. What Ice told me, and it's a very short passage in this book, Split Decision. You know, he gets laid up. He's a player. He's a hustler. Never got high. Never got drunk because he's an orphan. You know, he told me, you know, dude, when you're an orphan and you got no older brothers and sisters and you're in a place like South Central, you don't really have the luxury of getting fucked up. Because he said, I saw a lot of my friends getting taken advantage of, getting robbed. So he stayed sober. But, yeah, he evolved into a very, very sophisticated criminal. And they were doing jewel bashes, licks. They would call, you know, every score is a lick, right? But he said to me at one point, he goes, you know, I used to just idolize Iceberg Slim. And it's in the book. He says, and then I thought, wait, there's been thousands of pimps, right? Pimping is as old as human civilization. They were probably pimps
right.
back in, like, Mesopotamia, right? Like, back 5,000 years ago, they were pimps. He goes, but what made Iceberg Slim special was that he documented it. He wrote it down. And then he kind of said, so what I got to do, because he was in a car accident, he got, you know, his Porsche got T-boned at an intersection. He was John Doe'd in the county hospital in L.A., and he nearly died. And he said, man, I got to document this stuff. That's the only thing that's going to make my life special is if I write this shit down. So that's when he started, you know, obviously it was 6 in the morning was the first, you know, what we consider gangster rap, although he was influenced by Schooly D and the Philly gangs that Schooly D talked about, Parkside
yeah,
Killers.
Yeah, TFK, what is the name? Yeah, Parkside TFK,
yeah.
What does it mean? Yeah. Yeah.
Ice is so upfront, by the way, you know, you're quoting his lyrics. Ice is so, he's the realest dude I've ever met in terms of entertainers, and I've met a lot of these guys. Because he'll say, look, you know, at 6 in the morning, I love the cadence. I heard PSK, what is it? I heard, it's in a club in West Hollywood, I think it was, or wherever it was in L.A. And he said, this shit is so dusted. It sounds like angel dust. Like, what the fuck is he? That song, PSK, is so stripped down. It's just, like, echoey. And then you can tell he's talking about something street, but it's not very specific. So he said, I just took his cadence, and I think he contacted Schooly G and said, I want to do a version of this. The same way, by the way, with one of his best-known songs, Colors. It was King Son had mythological rap. He goes, you know, I love that cadence. And he said to me, Doug, it's not a bite if you acknowledge it. Like, if you tell the other rapper, man, it's only biting if you fucking steal it and just say that. I didn't, you know, because he always says, I took Schooly D's cadence and I made it about L.A. gangster shit.
Right.
And that's what we would call influence, right? If I write something and I think, wow, Ernest Hemingway did this beautifully. Let me do my version of that. It's not stealing. It's not plagiarism. But there's plenty of rappers
right.
who have actually just bitten other rappers' ideas and all that.
No, Doug.
But yeah,
Doug, you remember?
Sorry,
oh, go
yeah.
ahead, go ahead.
I was gonna say, so the original gangster rap song, I would say, is PSK. Mm-hmm. We're Making That Green. But the original West Coast gangster rap song is 6 in the morning, police at my door, fresh Adidas squeaking across the bathroom floor. I mean, that's the one that if you go on YouTube. A lot of my younger friends will tell me, I thought, you know, no, did gangster rap start with Cube and Dre? And I said, go
no,
listen to them
no,
talk
it
about
didn't.
Hear it 6 in the morning, like, influenced them because it was about their lives. They could relate to the reference.
Right. Right. And that's true because people have to understand Straight Outta Compton, you know, came out in 1988. Ice-T's Ron Pace album came out in 1986. You know, that predated
yep.
it, you know, by 2 years. And it also came out the same year as Schooly D's, you know, Live from Saturday Night. So you're dealing with this, you're dealing with where hip-hop had this trajectory from party rap, from Rapper's Delight in 1978 to
yep.
more of the Melly Mel, you know, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, 1984 with The Message, to where it becomes not necessarily gangster rap yet, but it has the template for what it would be in terms of those social observations. Of course, you have LL.
Well, listen,
all three of us
are communicators, mm-hmm. right? So I'll tell you this. I started mm-hmm. off trying to sound like Melly Mel. He was
okay.
doing these Dog in the Wax. He was doing songs, and he was trying to sound like a New York rapper because that, honestly, everybody in the West Coast knew New York was creating this new music. So he was
right.
at this club called The Radio, and then, you know, in Breakin', they call it the Radiotron. And he said, I was just trying to sound like the New York rappers. And then this guy, Randy Mack, one of his, you know, guys in the Rhyme Syndicate, said, yo, man, just start talking that real shit you always talk with us. And he goes, nobody wants to hear all that negativity. But that's where Six in the Morning is actually a B-side on a song called Dog in the Wax. And if you listen to Dog in the Wax, it sounds more like a Kool Moe Dee, Big Daddy Kane. No, not Big Daddy Kane. Sorry, Kool Moe Dee, LL Cool J. Just boastful, you know. It wasn't reality rap. And Ice actually said there was no term gangster rap until Cube said from a gang called, you know, Ends With Attitude. That's when the media latched on that. But he said, I called it my reality rap, and it was my reality.
Right,
it wasn't everybody's
right.
reality. So,
and
getting back to it, like,
yeah.
The New York, obviously yeah. the New York rappers, just given the, you know, since we're going to do a little history thing here, New York rappers, mm-hmm. I think in the early days, certainly like, you know, Flash, except for the one exception to it, which is The Message. The New York rappers were trying to entertain people and make these lavish costumes that look kind of like P-Funk and be like, you know, let's escape this reality. They didn't want to drag people back
right,
into stories
right.
about gangsterism. But the problem was, Ice told me, all those New York raps, he said, they just sounded fucking goofy. He said, honestly, to real players and hustlers and street cats in L.A., they just sounded goofy. They didn't relate to it. They didn't relate to the throw your hands in the air and all that party shit. But when he did Six in the Morning, he said they related to that, right? Like, so part of it was just, you know, fulfilling a need for the marketplace, right? Like, these Crips and Bloods, they were living such a hardcore life. They didn't want to hear this. I don't know. It wasn't their reality, I guess. Hearing as crazy as Melly Mel is and all those guys, it didn't resonate yet with L.A. the way that when Ice and then later on N.W.A., Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Ren, all those guys, they brought a different – and also up in the Bay, Too Short. I mean, these
right.
guys were doing stuff that really hit home because people want to hear stuff that actually references their reality, right?
Absolutely. And when you're thinking about it during that time, Doug, you're absolutely right. When you're looking at where hip-hop back in the day, well, it was because it was rap music, even for all the issues, you know, that Bambaataa has had has been well documented, Afrika Bambaataa, he did give hip-hop his name. Hip for being current on what's going on with the trends of the game, and then hop moving forward in terms of being pragmatic and evolutionary in the progress of it all.
Yep.
But like you said, when you look at a lot of the artists during the time, like, you know, the Fat Boys, Slick Rick and Dougie Fresh, you know, Roxanne Shante, UTFO, Kool Moe Dee, LL, New York was still in its aesthetic of the party vibe. It was about
yep.
really, you know, catering
yeah.
to that good time because this is the Big Apple. Now, when you're dealing with it and... we're going to get into much more of this. Oh, God, because this is great right now. Oh, and before we get into it even further, Ice-T, if you're listening, thank you from the bottom of our hearts so very much for sharing our show on your story.
You're lying.
No idea how much. Man, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. If you're listening, even if you're not,
looking out.
We're going to have... Man, we're going to have this, of course, on YouTube, SoundCloud link. We'll send it to Doug. You can listen, but we just want to say during the show, before we get any further, you are a legend to us. You are one of our OGs. You are one of our uncles in this thing. We just want to say thank you again.
Yeah, respect. Respect Ice, man.
Yeah, yeah. So as we go along, and shout out to Al Patron, Spike, Donald D, and the rest of Rhyme Syndicate as well. We cannot leave you guys out because you are just as integral to this discussion, to this story of music that we are dissecting, disseminating, and documenting right now. So we want to give everybody their proper acknowledgement. But getting back to it, so when we look at where hip-hop was, because in New York, all the real G's, the real hustlers, the real gangsters, they weren't rhyming about it. They were
no, exactly.
So
there's a very good interview with Melly Mel with a guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, DJ V. I won't say his name. And Melly Mel is saying, "Man, we started the shout out." And I know, so there are these clubs, right? So the T Connection, Disco Fever, Harlem World, these legendary places. The real gangsters were in there with their guns, and they just So I said, yo, put my name in that fucking shit, man. And if you didn't, you'd get shot. They, you know, Melly Mel has said, you could be talking all that gangster shit in the Bronx in 1975. You'd get shot. So nobody, these guys were not trying to act harder than they were. Something changed in the mid-90s. And, respect to Nas, respect to Biggie and all these guys. They were not the big kingpins. You know, Nas was not Escobar, obviously. You know, if you're at that level, the feds have you in their radar and they will take you down. So, but right. I view them as journalists. I view them almost as journalists. They're documenting the stuff that they lived and saw very intimately, and they were close to it. But the real gangsters, you don't want to put your shit out there like that, man. Like, you're making enough money selling drugs.
No.
It's a very, very... I mean, it might be a little bit different in Virginia, but I remember I spent... Sorry for the digression. I remember I had an assignment to go hang out with Master. Master P was, like, filming a movie. Of all things, he was filming a prison film, and it was in an abandoned prison in New Mexico. And I go out there, and, you know, his real name is what? Percy Miller. Hanging out with this guy. He's an interesting, fascinating guy. But every guy that was around him, dude, these were real fucking G's. Like, they were like killers. They were... And there was a definite shift where the guys that were getting in hip hop by like the late 90s were bringing a lot of real guys from that world very close to it. But in the first generation, Melly Mel, all those guys, I was going to say, we were just trying to entertain those dudes, man. We didn't pretend to be from that fucking world. Those guys were too real. They were too savage. And they didn't have the patience to even, you know, even if a guy, let's say, who was a killer or gangster, whatever, I mean, they wouldn't have the discipline and patience to, like, be waiting around for their turn on the microphone. I mean, you guys know more about this than me, probably, but, like, yeah, real gangsters, you know, they've been to prison. They don't like waiting for the phone. They're just very impulsive and narcissistic, and they're just the kind of stuff you have to do as an entertainer. Gangsterism and entertaining are not compatible, right? Like, the gangsters are the guys that are just like, I want this shit now, man. Like, anyway, but I think that, the first generation of New York guys were trying to uplift people. And I'll give you one more thing about the old school, and then we can move on. But, like, the old school, this was in the disco fever in the 70s when hip-hop was starting. Hollywood had a residency, I think, on Wednesdays, and Flash had Tuesdays. I mean, just all the legends. I think the first show that Run DMC did was at the Disco Fever. But they told me that the song that was the biggest thing was Ain't No Stopping Us Now, more than any other
right.
song. Like, just, you know, that kind of, like, let's get out of this shit. We're, like, in a miserable environment. We're in crime and poverty and the schools suck. Nobody wanted to hear all that stuff about, like, prison. I mean, enough people had problems with family members in prison, guns, all that stuff. It wasn't really in the lyrics. It really wasn't. But
well, what happened?
Anyway,
yeah.
Every culture and every movement takes a shift, and so the shift happened in the 90s, right? And we're still dealing with it, right? The trap music, the drill music, all that stuff now is still an offshoot of gangster rap to me, although I'm not well versed in it. But
no, it is. And what we saw, Doug, is the 80s moved on, because when N.W.A. dropped Straight Outta Compton in 1988, it brought a whole nother level. I mean, with songs like Fuck the Police, I mean, you know, all of that. I mean, Straight Outta Compton, because if people really understand what was happening during that time, everything had to evolve, because we were seeing the East Coast iteration of it. We had not seen the West
yep.
Coast iteration. And the West Coast
yep.
iteration was a lot more nuanced, because you're bringing in gang culture, which is a lot more up until there were two paradigm shifts that came along with it. One was Straight Outta Compton, and part two was Oliver Stone when he dropped Colors, the movie. That was where you
yep.
really began to see it start to really shift. Ice Cube on his second album of Death Certificate, My Summer Vacation, brought it full circle when he talked about the migration that would eventually go into the Midwest. This will go into the allegiance of the Vice Lords and Bloods and the Gangster Disciples and the Crips, known as the 8-Ball. That's a totally different story. But for those listening, you know what I'm talking about when I say this. So
yep.
One thing about it, when we look at America, America has always had a fascination with the criminal, whether it be John Dillinger, Al Capone,
yep.
Dirty Boy
yep.
Floyd, Machine Gun Kelly, Frank Lucas, of course, Bumpy Johnson, Wild Bill Hickok, you know, Billy the Kid.
This is a great point.
You know,
this is a really important point you're making. It didn't start with gangster rap. It goes back to the Cowboys and the Outlaws and Wyatt Earp. And
exactly.
It's a very deep, the 30s, it is as American as apple pie.
Rebel.
The gangster as, yep, exactly.
And when you look at this country, King and Doug, this was founded on revolution, going back to the Boston Massacre with the first casualty being Christus Attuck. So
yep.
We were trying to break from the crown. So we have always, American culture has always had an intrinsic link with going against the grain of what would be considered decorum and polite society. Not to say that we are uncivilized, but our roots are from an aggressive, take-no-prisoners nature of this is what we want. Back in the day during the American Revolution, our thing was we want freedom. We had the Boston
yep.
Massacre. Then we had the Boston Tea Party. You know, ultimately, it would lead into the Revolutionary War. You know, but before that, the founding of the Continental Congress. You know, so there were a lot of machinations going back to the 1700s. Late 1700s, they were going to sow the seeds of what American society would end up being to this day, in terms of even going back to the 1930s with bootlegging. Of course, when you know the history of people that were involved with that, even from your country, Doug, you know, with Seagrams and all that, they were involved in a
yes,
lot
right.
of that as well.
Right.
You
the Bronfman,
so
one of the wealthiest families in the world, were Jewish family that was
and even
Bronfman,
the Kennedys,
and they
yeah.
were very involved in supplying. I think Boardwalk Empire did a pretty good job of showing it was just another issue of supply and demand, just like with crack cocaine or any other. If people want it, somebody's going to supply it. So people wanted alcohol, and fortunes were made. Let's
yeah.
put it that way.
And when you think about how the paradigm shift came, Doug, when you look at the 90s, there was a whole other market that had been tapped opening up, because it was something up until this time in the 90s, we didn't know nothing about gang culture. So when we start seeing
right.
it, in that same year, you have King T drop his debut album, Act a Fool. Shout out to the
yep.
you know, King T out in
Oh,
Compton.
Man, I love, by
you
the
know,
way, I love that. I still to this day love that song, Act a Fool. It is an underrated
yeah.
West Coast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, I mean, next year, you know, Compton's Most Wanted would drop their joint, you know,
yep.
straight checking them. You know, so I mean, this is within from 1988 to 1995, and I'm gonna just name off album titles because those in the know are already gonna know what I'm talking about. You're talking about Straight Checking Them. It's a Compton thing. Death Certificate, The Predator.
Yep.
Born and Raised in Compton. That was DJ Quick's debut. You know what I'm saying? Of course. The Chronic, Doggy Style, you know, it was once they saw how viable it became. I mean, who can forget the Ghetto Boys? You know, Griffith on that other level. You
yep.
know, I
yep.
mean,
yep.
you know, Mr. Scarface is back. You know, Little Big Man, Bushwick Bill. You know, I mean, it was like.
I mean, to me, Diary of a Madman by Scarface is one of the greatest albums I ever heard. You know, I mean, just hearing his voice,
yeah.
the cadence. But I'm just gonna, you know, piggyback on what you said there. Like, I married a woman when I got to New York. I met a woman who'd grown up in the Bronx, Caribbean family, but also, you know, her father's side came from Savannah, Georgia, And she had been to these early, you know, they just called them park jams. They weren't called anything. They were just jams in the park, right? Flash would spin.
Mm-hmm.
And the gang, just visualize this. These names don't even ring a bell for most young people. Savage Nomad, Savage Skulls, Black Spades. They look more like Hell's Angels motorcycle gangs. If you look at the jackets, they had their patch. They had the whole, and these were some violent motherfuckers. Like, I mean, my now ex-wife, she told me there was blocks in the Bronx where you couldn't go down that block because the Savage Nomads were known for raping women down there. They raped a nun. Like, just crazy shit. And L.A. had its Crips and Bloods, but New York stuff was a lot more. When I look at the photos of these guys, they just literally look like Hell's Angels with afros, you know? Like, just, they had these,
literally,
like, out of the, well, Warriors. You remember that movie? Like, it was like that shit.
Yeah.
It was really, like, and New York wasn't organized to have, like, an entire part of the city being Crip or, you know, blue and red. They were all like individual gangs, except for the Black Spades. And what Bambaataa did actually was to make the Zulu Nation, you know, and of course we know like all these allegations. But yeah, he took that Black Spade mentality as a gang guy and said, let's turn it into something a little more Afrocentric, a little more cultural. And by the way, so ISIS, you know, ISIS, key producer in the early days was Africa Islam, who was from the Zulu Nation,
mm-hmm.
president. And he said, I asked Ice about forming the Rhyme City. He goes, I love New York. I was in New York, and I love this vibe of the Zulu Nation. But I also realized L.A. was way too gangster to bring something like Afrocentric like the Zulu Nation. So I had to bring something that sounded gangster. So the Syndicate, like I read up on Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano, and they created the commission back in the so the Rhyme Syndicate was like, you know, we're all bosses, so we're not going to take each other's heads off. He said LA could not have handled something as Afrocentric as Zulu Nation. They, you know, which, you know, God bless Zulu Nation. They had, you know, Tribe Called Quest, all these great groups used to be under this, you know, banner of, what do you want to call it, cultural consciousness. It's not even Afrocentric.
Yeah,
it's just,
it was a
conscious movement, because when you look at those New York days, you had gangs like the Decepticons and all of them, of course, the Lowlife. Shout out Third, of course. You know, so
yep.
New York, for those that know, when Walter Hill dropped the Warriors, when it dropped in, I believe, 79, that was a real movie, because from the opening sequence, when you see Cyrus addressing all the gangs in New York City, when he's talking about over 50,000 gang members, I mean, that was no exaggeration. That was really how it was during that time. And, you know, that's really what it was like going on at that particular point. So there had to be a conduit that would facilitate everybody coming together, where there would be a coalescence rather than conflict. It would be cooperation rather than being, you know, carnage. And that's where
exactly.
The Zulu Nation would eventually birth from. Now, in L.A., and shout out to, you know, to everybody we know in L.A. from all sides of the flag, Blood, Crip, and Piru, who we talk to on a regular basis off air. When you look at the geographical divide of it, L.A. is, when you look at New York is recognized by five boroughs. Now, if you look at Los Angeles County is broken up into 88 different cities. That encompasses all of Los Angeles. So this is a whole, I mean, when I talked about how they would have had a time, I mean, dude, and you figure in the 80s, this is before Ice really gets big, but you figure even from 1979 to 1986, before Ice really gets on, you figure L.A. by itself during that time was probably running with about maybe close to 150,000 gang members, give or take.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, so this is
and
like...
And the thing about it is, like,
yeah.
If you guys have probably spent time in both cities. When you're in New York, everybody ends up on the subway. You know, you're on the subway, you're on the train, you're on it. In L.A., you got to have a car.
Right.
I mean, and these neighborhoods.
Right.
So what I noticed is, like, and this is, like, I'm going to use some gangster games. you know, in the mafia, in the Italian mafia, they'll say, who are you with? Like, if somebody sees another guy in a club, who are you with? You know who I'm with? I'm with so-and-so. Like, I'm with this crew. It's the same stuff with African-American and Latino. Yeah, it's like, who am I with? Well, I'm with these guys. In L.A., it's where you're from. Like, what neighborhood are you from? And your neighborhood is your identity. And it could be third generation. Like, man, I'm 60s. I'm 30s. I'm you know, Santana
Block. I'm A-Tray. I'm neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
I'm Athens. You know, I'm Cedar Block.
New York is much more fluid and based on crews. It's based on, like, you know, my crew, we're making money. Yeah, we're from East, you know, Jimmy Henchman, we're from East Flatbush. We'll fuck with Uptown. In L.A., you don't really get away from your neighborhood. I learned this from Spike, who's obviously the other protagonist. He was like, he would go fuck with guys in other neighborhoods, and they would say, so apparently they don't say where you're from anymore. They say, what's that Palmer block like? They'll call you out. And I said to Spike, like, how do you answer to it? You got to either say, I'm not gangbanging, but you can't claim to be you're not from another neighborhood, and you got to tell them. And just going into another neighborhood, you can get killed. Or the fact that your brother
was
a fucking gangbanger. And that doesn't really exist in New York so much. There's not guilt by association in New York. I don't know about Chicago, because Chicago has its very deep, you know, the fault and the people and all the, you know, vice versa. But New York is much more fluid. What I realized about L.A. is it's, you use the exact right word, my brother. You said geographical. L.A. is much more geographical. It is geographical. It's where are you from? What's your neighborhood? Where did your grandmother live? And you are just, you can't switch neighborhoods. You know what I mean? Whereas I think in New York, you can actually switch crew. You could say, yo, I used to be with these guys, Alpo, and now I'm with these other guys.
Man.
You can actually be a free agent.
Man. But it's wild, because the thing was, when we look at the gang elements in New York, that would not come until really recognized in the early 90s, which would be from OG Mac, which would start UBN, United Blood Nation, in the, you know, New York prison system, you know, which would eventually kind of filter down. Most notably, of course, the Bronx is really known for where the Bloods really had a proliferation. This goes back to what was going on with Pistol Pete Rolick at the time, a.k.a. Pistol Pete, and his crew, S&M Sex Money Murder. And how that happened was him and OG happened to meet up in prison. And OG, you know, Mac was like, yo, I rock with your movement that you got on the outside of the street. You know what I'm saying? You know, you really keeping a gangsta out there. You know, how about, you know, I want you to come in with us. And Pete was like, that's cool. You know, I come in under the Blood flag, but the thing is, I run that game independently, but we will be part of it. And that's how S&M became identified with Blood Nation. I can't speak from the Crip side of it, because I don't know the origins of how the Crip culture made it, you know, to the East Coast. I only really know about what it is.
I was there for the same thing. It was Rikers Island. You heard nothing about Bloods and Crips in New York, 92, 93.
But
93, 94.
Right.
Yeah, it was Latin Kings, Nietas. It was Latino gangs in the prison system. And there really wasn't, you know, there were the 5%ers. So the guys I knew that went to prison, if you were righteous, you know, they didn't, you know, you, everybody bonds in prison based on their racial group, right? But by 93, you're right, we started to hear about Bloods, and I knew guys that started to get down with Crips, and I was like, what do you know about Crips? Like, what the fuck? This is not from New York. But it was L.A. transplants who brought it to New York, and it became entrenched. It definitely was. Now, I'm going to take it back one more step further. Like, Spike is from a neighborhood called 30s. Now, 30s in L.A. is also called Harlem Crips. And I was like, I did some deep dive. I did some, you know, I'm a good journalist, I think. I'm a decent journalist. And I'm like, why the fuck do they call them Harlem Crips? Well, there was one guy from the neighborhood back in the 70s when the gangs were, who had come from New York, and he was from Harlem. That's one theory. Because I still say, yo, I'll fuck with the 60s. I'll fuck with Harlem. Harlem in L.A. means the 30s, dirty 30s, rolling 30s. But it was originally a guy from New York who was from Harlem. So it goes both ways. And then by the 90s, you have guys from L.A. coming out and bringing this. I never thought red flags and blue flags until the 93, 94. And then it got really serious, you know. So, you know, it got to the point where, you know, there were whole neighborhoods then became. And at first I thought it was kind of like wannabes, but it's not wannabes. Like, they actually got into it, but they're not like, you know, Big U and these guys who really grew up in these neighborhoods and, you know, they're entrenched. And it's fairly new to New York. But some of it might be fashion. I don't know. It seems like it's kind of cool to be a blood now. You know, Cardi B and Tekashi 6ix9ine. I'm like, they're blood.
Man.
They're claiming blood.
Shout out to our good friend Sean Cicero of Complex Magazine. We had him on a couple of years ago. For those that have not read his book, Dummy Boy, about Tekashi, it's a great read. Pick it up. In addition to Doug's book, you know, Split Decision, written with Ice-T and Certified Spike, both of you author tremendous tomes of timeless classics and composition.
Oh, thank you, man.
And also too, you know, Dave East, he's from Harlem and he represents Harlem 30. You know, we can only say this because Dave has been, you know, Dave has pretty much said it, you know, if you know where he's from, you hear it on the block that he does Rep 30. When you look at it, Doug, because your journalism, oh my God, I mean, it's about as diverse as my shoe collection. And I got a lot of shoes.
Me too, brother.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you talk about New York, we got to get into one of your books where you wrote about the SAP, Franklin Avenue Posse. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, so that was a guy named K-Wan. It was a 5%er. I met him, and he was aspiring to be a rapper, but he was a gangster. He'd done a bunch of shit that was notorious. In the time that I met him, you know, I just started hanging out with the dude because he kind of needed help negotiating. So the best-known crew that was, you know, actually signed from FAP was Buckshot, Black Moon. They represent, you know, he'll say in his lines, hit me when I represent the FAP or Franklin Avenue Posse. They're a crew. It was more based on cocaine dealing, crack dealing, and going down south to Virginia, Washington, D.C. These were some serious dudes, man. I would say it was much more influenced by the Caribbean culture, and these guys were like gunslingers. Like, every guy I met from that crew was be crazy. I'd be to this day, there's a guy named Justice. He's I think he's living in Atlanta now. And K-Wan said, yo, me and Just were going at it in D.C., shootouts and shit. And I'm like, yeah, we're all sitting here having pizza now. So it's all, like, dead and buried now. Like, you're not going to pull out your guns anymore. But, yeah, these guys were, like, they were the children who came of age in 85, 86 when crack just blew up. And they saw the opportunity to make money. You know, it destroyed communities. It wasn't... None of it was pretty, the amount of murders and all that stuff. But, yeah, that exposed me to this world and also to that hip-hop world of the 90s, which we're talking about. You know, Biggie was about 3 or 4 years younger than these guys. So Biggie was from Bed-Stuy. Franklin Avenue, if you were – Mike Tyson was more like East New York, Brownsville, where he grew up.
Right, Brooklyn.
Yeah. But this is all – Brooklyn is so big. When you get out there – like, my mother was born in Coney Island. That's a – Brooklyn is 4 million people, right? It's a separate city unto itself. But I remember reading this book called Fire and Fury, which was by Jose Torres. And it was an early biography of Mike Tyson before he was just the young heavyweight champion who was obviously a troubled guy. And, you know, shout to Mike because he's really mellowed with weed and he's not the kind of – destructive. He's such an introspective and actually philosophical guy now. But people will talk about, yeah, Mike Tyson grew up in, you know, in Brownsville. Well, I met these dudes who were like 5 years older than Mike, and they would say, yeah, man, I used to beat the shit out of Mike Tyson. This guy, Tom Roof. These were like street fighting guys, right? And if you really listen to Mike, he goes, I was getting bullied. I would get beat up all the time. That's why he went to boxing. But, I mean... In that book, Fire and Fury by Jose Torres, Mike talks. Mike says, I was in Brownsville, I was in East New York, but Crown Heights, that's where the real gangsters were. Now,
yeah.
It's because a lot of them were like Caribbean guys, and people have heard of Jimmy Henchman. They've heard of
Haitian Jack.
God, who's the guy? Haitian Jack. Yeah, they were all that's more East Flatbush. But man, they just brought this shoot 'em up mentality. Nightclubs were shot up. I mean, there's a place called Love People. It was a Jamaican disco on Empire Boulevard, right there at Crown Heights. It was called Love People, and my boy K-1 said, "Yeah, man, we used to call it Dead People." Because every week there was a coroner's hearse, like it was. I mean, the thing about Jamaicans, I don't know if you know this, but it used to be in the '70s and '80s. Yeah, shower policy, spangler policy, and they guys would get shot. You said, "Man, you step on my body," like you scuffed up my shoes, boom, you got shot. And there's many people were there, and nobody talked about it. Nobody told the police. The most infamous in my time in New York was. And I love Supercat. Supercat's one of my favorite dancehall artists, but there was a very famous incident with a guy named Nitty Gritty. And everybody in Brooklyn knows the story. Supercat shot and killed Nitty Gritty. And nobody told the police
Whoa.
Shit. I mean, it's still talked about. Yeah, it's still talked about. But, yeah, it was just this. Man, these guys were wild. They were fucking wild. I mean, I'll give you a couple of really funny stories. Once I was walking along with K-1 and a couple of guys. We were just in the middle of Crown Heights. And I said, he's got this big-ass fucking .45 Colt revolver, sorry, Colt pistol on his fucking waist. And I'm not comfortable. Like, we're in broad daylight with a fucking Colt. And I said something like, dude, do you clean your gun? I used to wear, like, remember they used to call it, like, backpack hip-hop? Like, I had the big, I had the JanSport backpack. I had the goatee, and everybody thought I was, like, a little Puerto Rican guy or something. So I'm walking around, I'm like, do you clean your gun? And he said, man, boy, ask me if me clean me steel. Bam, bam. He starts licking off shots like, bam, 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 bam. And because in Jamaican slang, rinsing your gun or cleaning your gun is to, like, let off shots. And I didn't mean for – but anyway, he does that. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's like fucking 2 p.m. like on a fucking Thursday. It's in my book. He shoves the fucking still smoking 45 in my bag. And he goes, cross Empire Boulevard. Eastern Parkway. I had to cross Eastern Parkway. And I'm like, what the fuck are you giving me? We were supposed to meet at this pizzeria owned by this Italian guy. And he goes, ain't no beast. Ain't no, Babylon's not going to stop a fucking white boy walking down the street. But anyway, it was just all I had to say to him was, do you clean your gun? And he literally licked off shots. But by the way, so Labor Day weekend in Brooklyn, it's notorious. I mean, guys are just gunman salute. That comes from Jamaica, but then, like, guns are just blast, blast, blast. Like, yeah. And a couple times they almost got robbed. And, there are some guys in Brooklyn that are just wolves. They're just wolves looking for the weaker prey. They don't care who you're with. I would hear these stories about, Buster Rhymes got robbed, Mike Tyson got robbed. Like, these are just like infamous stories. I told this kid just before we went on the air, I was like, we were talking about jewelry, right? Jacob the Jeweler and how these guys, like I said something in the book. He goes, man, the most we used to wear was maybe $100,000 of jewelry. But you got these guys out here now wearing $1 million, $2 million in jewelry. And this is what led to, Ice made this comment about, I'm so sorry for the young fellow that got killed at
what happened with
B&B Rock.
What happened with B&B Rock on Maine and Manchester.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I said, we don't wear, you look at me and Cube and so we don't wear our big jewelry when we're in LA. Why test the streets? And some people like clap back at him on Twitter, like, well, why you got to say it like that? But he's like, dude, there's guys out here that are just, they don't give a fuck who you are. So
right.
I knew this guy.
Right.
He might be listening. I don't know. Supreme. Great guy. I mean, wanted for a bunch of crimes, convicted of a few. He was in Clinton down to Moore. He was in Clinton with
Tupac.
Pac, and he got the thug life. He got the same thug life tattoo. But anyway, when Mike Tyson first came home from that, remember Desiree Washington, the rape conviction? And Mike Tyson got a big house in New Jersey, and there was like this pool party or some shit. Like, honeys are going to be there. And Prima's telling me, yo, Doug, we hitting up Mike Tyson's pool party. I was like, well, you got an invitation? He goes, no, man, we're going to be in the parking lot. We're just robbing motherfuckers. I was like, I don't care. Like, all the celebrities, these guys don't care. If you're, you know what I mean? If you are Puffy, if you're anybody walking in there and you got jewels on, they're just run them jewels, man. I mean, Brooklyn, you know, I'm sorry, like Biggie represented that Brooklyn mentality in, oh God,
give me the
loot.
Loot.
There's a
give
couple,
me the loot. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And there used to be a chant, right? Like money, you know, money making Manhattan, but Brooklyn is basically taking shit. And I saw that firsthand. I was like, man, these guys are just, they don't care who you are, what your reputation is. You're the heavyweight champion of the world. You're wearing a lot of jewelry. You know, well, give me that shit. Here's a gun to your head. So, you know, I was around those guys, and they were, that was an education. I got an education.
But also, yeah.
What to say. Visited guys on Rikers Island, visited guys upstate New York, same thing, all this shit. And, you know, honestly, as a guy that was born and raised in Canada, it also showed me, getting a bit serious here, about the discrepancy in housing and I mean, everything in the States, when you actually visit, when you move there from another country, you just see how racially and ethnically and educationally, like, it's just, it's not a fair playing field, right? You go to these housing projects in East New York, and it literally is like The Wire. You know, guys, all the elevators
yeah.
smell of piss. It's not safe for
yeah.
grandmothers to go get their groceries. You know, I mean, the worst thing I remember seeing once, and I put this in the book, I think. I'm hanging out with this guy, Supreme's brother, Life. Good guy. Like, now he, you know, he did a gun running charge. I think he got busted. They all used to come from Brooklyn down south to where you guys, you know, like Virginia, you could buy guns with a straw man purchase, get a girlfriend to buy a bunch of guns, and then bring them back up to New York. That was a big thing back in the 90s. It was more lucrative than crack, right? Buying cheap guns and then selling them on the streets of New York. But I went out to see him, and I was like, man, we're in East New York. And we go to the corner store, the local place where you can buy, like, you know, cigarettes, whatever. And you can't even interact with the shirt. I mean, there's so many robberies. It's all bulletproof glass. And the only interaction takes place between a little, almost like a little mini revolving door of plexiglass, of, you know, bulletproof glass. So it's almost like you felt like people living in these neighborhoods are being treated like animals by everything, by the cops, by the shopkeepers. And I just found it, you know, on some level so depressing, because, like, how do you grow up in that place and feel like you can get out of it, right? Especially if
Matter
you didn't
fact.
Have a chance to get it. Sorry.
Matter of fact, though, I don't know if you're familiar with this movie by Matty Rich called Straight Out of Brooklyn. You familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
For those that know it, Larry Gilliar from The Wire, you know, that was his film debut, as well acting. But that was this was in the early 90s when that movie came out, and that was gritty back then. Because that was really about how Brooklyn was. I mean, when you think about how ill Brooklyn is, if you listen to the song Brooklyn with Kashmir, Big Daddy Kane, Joel Ortiz, and Mano, you know, Mano has that line, you know, her Steph still got a chain in Brooklyn. Now, for those that don't miss that reference, that was when Stephon Marbury, who's from Coney Island, he got his chain.
Yep.
He was riding down the street, I think. This was back in, like, 99, 2000, open air Bentley, 2 a.m. They ran up on him and they ran him for it. And that was that. And I know exactly which chain that they got, because it was that diamond. It was that diamond link with the number 3 on it, which was valued at $180,000.
If you're desperate and you see a guy with that much money coming back through the neighborhood, and this is part of the reason, you know, you read about this a lot in hip-hop. Well, our guys, you know, the minute New York rappers make money, they move to Alpine, New Jersey. They move to these, you know, gated communities. It's tough to go back to the neighborhood. It really is. Like, it's tough,
right?
Even if your friends are there, because you got a certain kind of guy. There's not many of them, but they're really hungry and desperate, and they don't care. They don't care who you are. Yeah, so those stories are all real. I remember I wrote an article in the New York Times about when Jacob Arabo, Jewish guy from Kazakhstan, he starts Jacob the Jeweler. And Jay-Z had said, you know, I took you out of Jacob's in clusters. And I was like, who's this guy? So I went to the Diamond District, and he goes, yeah. He showed me this diamond pinky ring he was making for Busta, who was like, it was like the size of a walnut. It was huge. And I said,
yeah.
Well, who's going to wear a pinky ring, you know, worth $5 million? Like, first of all, every other person will think it's cubic zirconium because who would have a ring that big? And if you're not the king of England or queen of England, and if you are wearing it and it's real and you don't have like 50 guys with machine guns, someone's going to take it from you. I mean, that's the complicated thing about, you know, hip hop extravagance and the materialism and all that stuff is that these guys are doing it for status and to, you know, whatever. And if you do go back to that neighborhood that you were born into, there are guys that just don't care who you are. And there's also a lot of jealousy. You know, let's be honest about that. There's a lot of guys who are angry and jealous that you made it. And they'll take your shit. So it happens to ballers like Stephon Marbury. It happened to Tyson several times. I remember hearing Mike Tyson got robbed. I mean, it wasn't well publicized. It wasn't, like, reported. But it was just like, dude, if you're driving your nice car, I remember Mike Tyson had a three-wheeled motorcycle, like a trike. He was riding around. I mean, one thing about Mike that was so cool, I remember this, he just come back. He used to just, like, hang out in the neighborhood. Mike was such a real guy back then. Like, you'd hear about it and be like, yeah, Mike Tyson was just hanging out and like, with his money. Like, why did he need to do that? But I think he got refreshed, and it kept him grounded to see these guys that he grew up with, right? But yeah, anyway, so getting back to that was the first book, and that was my education into this gangster world, but also a little bit into the 90s hip-hop scene, which was, I mean, I still fuck with, you know, people don't listen to it much. Buckshot, Black Moon, Smith & Wesson,
yeah.
Sean Price, I mean, Boot Camp Click. I mean, I don't know, people don't really play their shit that much anymore, but the sound of it was so unique to me. There was also Jerry with the Damager, M.O.P.
Yeah.
Like,
yes. Yes.
Brooklyn was bringing a lot of really cool shit to the table at that time. Biggie, you know, obviously gets the most, you know, the most kudos now, and rest in peace. Like, he was one of the greatest lyricists and the greatest flow and all that. But there were a lot of guys out there that were just like, I mean, Biggie owes a lot to Big Daddy Kane to me. Like, I mean, Big Daddy Kane was the first Brooklyn guy that I heard from that was like, wow. Yeah, up till then, it was Uptown and Queens, right?
Yeah, but when you think about it during that time, man, you know, New York, the New York era was just, especially when you know, we got to shout out Corona Queens. That's where Cool G Rap is from. When you shout out QB,
yep.
You got to shout out Black Poet, you know, Tragedy Gaddafi, you know, they were the first generation, Craig G, MC Shan, a good friend of ours, you know, these would be the godfathers before Nas, Blakey, Capone, and Noriega. This would be before all of them will come in the game. One thing about it is when you look at that aesthetic of it, New York was grimy, gritty, unpredictable, wild. All things that entail danger, and you had to have somebody to narrate that. As you talked earlier, Doug, about the origins of hip-hop in terms of the rhythms and the spoken word, in Africa they would call them griots. They were the the village historians who were the living repositories orally, you know, retelling the history of a village, and it was no different when it came to, you know, hip-hop in the United States. Doug, you're...
And by the way, let me just interject real quick. This is going on a real intellectual tangent here, but, like, my daughter's 20, and she grew up, so she's African-American and Jewish, I'll buy that. And I was talking about, like, you know, the memorization that goes into, you know, a guy like Jay-Z who doesn't write stuff down. I said, but you got to remember something. You know, as a graduate student, I read all the slave narratives like Nat Turner and, I mean, but, you know, Frederick Douglass said the most scary thing to the slave master was if we learned to read, if we became literate, right? So the oral tradition was so highly developed, especially in the South, because so passing on stories with long, maybe long memorization, almost like Homer, right? And that's why, I mean, one of the greatest things that happened to me writing that first book was just being in freestyle ciphers. I mean, I'm observing, obviously I can't rhyme, but I'm watching guys just go at it back and forth. Nothing, you know, they're passing the blunt, but they're also passing the mic, like, so to speak. And I was like, these guys are like, you know, they're contemporary Shakespeare's. Like, they're making up shit off the dome about each other, not written, just, and you're like, wow. So a lot of this comes from the idea that for African Americans, being taught to read and write was a very dangerous thing. We're not talking long ago, 1860. So the highly developed spoken word, which already has an African, but I see it as being really, really, really clearly like historic. Like, you know, African-American people in general, you know, there's a lot of great wordplay and self-deprecating and all that. And if you go to the churches and, but yeah, I think when you really look at the fact that for generations, African-American people were not taught to read and write intentionally, and that so they developed amazing storytelling abilities that required memorization. So people are like blown away. They look at, you know, Jay-Z in the you know, booth, and he doesn't write anything down. Well, he's got a great memory. And he's probably
I mean,
aunts and uncles who did the same shit, told them long stories.
Yeah.
Sean, sit down. I'm going to tell you a story. And it was like, it had a point, a beginning, middle, end. Like, Ice is one of the best storytellers I've ever met.
Yes,
and
he
it's
is.
Just not,
man.
By the way, it's just natural. Like, he doesn't stop and say, he tells a story, beginning, middle, end, punchline. He's just great at it, you know? And some of that's instinctive and some of it's learned, but there's definitely a tradition there that I think we all have to acknowledge and say, okay, you know, and the world is better for it. I mean, for all the flack that hip-hop gets for some of its content, it really has enriched our society in terms of, I mean, what? These young guys are using metaphors, similes, allegory. They're using all the poetic devices that we had to learn in university. They're using them just instinctively and or consciously. That's like poetry is being kept alive by hip-hop more than any other thing.
It is.
Modern day Shakespeare's, I would say.
It is. And Doug, your educational pedigree is Ivy League incredible. Being at the state, formerly known as the State University of New Jersey, known as Princeton now. Please tell us
Don't
about
remind me.
You know you. Go Tigers!
Okay, I'll tell you a great story about Princeton. They used to have all these eating clubs that were private, but there was this great spot to just hang out and listen to good music, and it was Michelle Robinson, who later became Michelle Obama, the first lady. She writes about it in Becoming. Back in the 80s, it was called the Third World Center. And even back then, I was like, this is kind of an offensive title. They've changed it. But they had the best fucking parties. And I got trained. So there was a, you know, an indie rock kind of radio station. It's called WPRB. So I said, okay, I'd like to be a DJ. I think it was freshman year, sophomore year. And they wanted me to play all these groups I didn't care about, the Replacements. And I was like, what the fuck is this shit? And somebody, I'll never forget, when you start to learn how to be a radio DJ, they give you the graveyard shift, like 1 a.m. till 4 a.m, right? Like nobody's listening. And some guy calls in and says, can you play Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five? And it was like a 12-minute record. And I'm like, holy shit, seriously, dude, I got to play this whole thing? I wasn't relating to it. I didn't like that. I go to this party at the Third World Center. It had to be around 1985 because LL Cool J's debut record, Radio, was just out. And I heard Rock the Bells. And it was kind of like go-go music or whatever. I mean, it was just the beat was so stripped down. And I went out and bought that vinyl. I still have it, 1985. I was like, holy shit. LL Cool J's Rock the Bells, I heard it at a Princeton party, and I was like, this is changing my life. Prior to that, I'd only heard Melly Mel, like, on the Chaka Khan going, Chaka Khan, I want to rock you, I want to rock you, Chaka Khan. Like, I really didn't know hip-hop. I wasn't really, you know, and it was more party music. Then when I heard Rock the Bells, of course, then we all heard, like, Sucker MCs and Run DMC. Yeah, I mean, honestly, well, for instance, a great education. I look back on it now, though, it was an education for me in lots of ways, including learning about hip-hop, learning about reggae, learning about stuff from people that my roommate was from Jamaica. So by 82, I went down to Jamaica with my roommate and was just like, then I fell in love with Yellow Man and Tiger and all these like, DJs that I'd never
oh,
heard.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
you take
yeah,
it back. Jelly Thunder,
yeah, I mean,
Cuddy Ranks.
Yeah.
Louis Rankin, rest in peace, a good friend of ours. Yeah.
I got a chance to go down there and see, like, Sunsplash and all that stuff. So, yeah, but I'm going to say something. A friend of mine was an English teacher at a private school on the Upper East Side, and he said it was – I forget why he asked me to come in. But he's got these 15, 16-year-old students, maybe 14, 15 – and they were not relating to sonnets by Shakespeare or Geoffrey Chaucer. So I came in and he goes, can you talk about writing? And I brought in all these hip-hop lyrics. I brought in Commons. I used to love her. And I was like, okay, listen, you know. And I said, I had them all read the lyrics, and then I played the song. And I said, so this is an allegory. Do you understand what an allegory? He's talking about hip-hop. He says it at the end. Who I'm talking about, y'all, is hip-hop. But it sounds like it's about a girl, and it's so. Then I went through, you know, whoever was big at that time. My favorite was, remember Keith Murray, the most
beautifulest thing in the world. Yeah.
Nobody ever talks about this, but I remember walking into this, and by the way, the principal, she was this old lady. She got salty because I played Foxy Brown or something, and it had some curse words, and she got mad at me. I got in trouble for that one. But I was trying to keep it clean. But I was like, Keith Murray had this song. It wasn't, I don't even remember the song. But he said, I'm the mad matador of metaphor. So I said, let's break that down. I wrote it on the blackboard or the whiteboard. I was like, mad matador of metaphor. Okay, so he's doing alliteration, mad matador of metaphor, LM. He's saying a metaphor about a metaphor. He's comparing himself to a matador. He's also doing internal rhyme. Yeah, I said he's doing like five fucking poetic devices in one little throwaway phrase. And, I mean, I was just trying to get the – and, you know, I thought the kids weren't listening to me, but at the end of the class, my friend goes, oh, man, they were so into it. And I said, what do you mean? They weren't even looking at me. Yeah, but if they weren't paying attention, they would have been, like, you know, throwing shit and doing all – they were into it. They just can't show the thing. And then when flash forward a year or two – Eminem's movie 8 Mile comes out, right? And I had been in Freestyle Cyphers. I'd been at the New Music Seminar, Battle for World Supremacy, Supernatural against Craig G. I mean, guys coming off the dome with crazy. And, you know, Eminem's movie comes out, and my editor at the New York Times at that time, well-meaning, like she didn't mean to be, you know, in any way condescending. She just said, but that wasn't real, right? I said, what do you mean? Guys making up stuff like on the spot like that. And I said, of course it is. It's called like coming off dome. Like, she goes, oh my God. So all these guys are like Shakespeare. I said, yeah. This is back in like whenever Eminem's movie came out, like 2001, 2002. And I said, yeah, but if you see it in real life, you'll see it. Like they're going to humiliate each other based on what they're wearing. And she said, but if they're doing that, then they're like, they're modern day Shakespeare's. I said, yeah, hello. I mean, this is at the time, mind you, like, people were still calling hip-hop well into the 90s a fad, right? They were still calling it a negative force or whatever. And I'm answering this in a very, very, very long-winded way about Princeton. I was like, you know what? I would take anything I learned at Princeton as an English major, literature major, and I can find that in pop music. I can find that in hip-hop. Hip-hop more than any other genre. I can find all the poetry and all the storytelling. Slick Rick, A Children's Story. Ice-T's Midnight. I mean, these are great stories told in 3.5 minutes, right?
Yeah.
It's as good as it gets in literature. And I think 50 years from now, they'll probably still be teaching some of these stories. I mean, hopefully, there'll be like a new revised edition of the Norton Anthology of English Literature, and they'll include some hip-hop. Because they should. I mean, I'd have to quiz you guys, but it never got better for me than Rakim. Like, Rakim was the most genius lyricist, poet, jazz musician, like everything about his cadence and flow and complexity. I hold the microphone like a grudge. Like, they were all happening at the same time for me. Slick Rick, I mean, I heard Kool G Rap being the first great storyteller, gangster kind of rapper, but then I heard Rakim and I said, wow, this is just a different level. Yep. Yep. And so if anybody asked me who
he
was,
he's trying to set the bar.
He didn't. And I saw Melly Mel in that same interview with DJ Vlad. He goes, you know, when Eminem came out, I didn't have to change the way I rhymed. But when he said two people. He said KRS-One and Rakim. He said, when Rakim came out, we all had to change the way he rhymed. We all had to change because we didn't hear the beats the same way that he did. You know, and that's, I think, just pops being a jazz musician. And I mean, when I hear Rakim to this day, I mean, I hold the microphone like a grudge. Like, it's just, hey, man, I'm sorry. It's a high point for me, high water for me. But then I sound like a fucking old fart saying, you know, it's better back in my days, man. But if I hear a guy saying, Drake is better than that Rakim, I'll say, how is Drake better than Rakim, man? What the fuck are you talking about?
And the thing is, but that's where a lot of times the metrics of the art and the artist get crossed, because then it comes into this, it's like the Venn diagram. You're looking at the art, the artist, and then you go into popularity, then you go into financial success. So you're having this coalescence of different aspects where people are looking at very, very metrics to determine it. Drake is a great artist. We're not going to dispute that. I mean, but people, when you talk about Canadian hip-hop, everybody talks about Drake. I'm like, but what about, you know, Cardinal Official? What about Chuck Clare? You know, yep. These are people that predated him. I mean, Canada, in terms, has a rich musical history. I mean, with Rush, you know, rest in peace, Neil Peart.
You do remember Cardinal Official? Before him, there was a guy, Mike Fresh West.
Search of Fire. Yeah, Search of Fire.
But these were guys that were trying to come down in New York. And this was what was so cool to me. When Drake hit, and I met this chick, I think she was from the Bronx, you know, beautiful African-American girl. She goes, oh, you're from Canada. Can you take me to the Six? And I'm like, what? Well, first of all, most people call it T.O. or T-Dot. Okay, that's Drake saying the Six. And I said, you do realize you're in New York City, which is 10 times cooler than Toronto. Toronto is not the cool. Drake thinks it sounds cool. I said, you sound like when I used to watch Beavis and Butthead and they would talk about Seattle. We just got to get to Seattle and like, it's the coolest. It's like, you do realize Seattle's not such a great, it's just a rainy city with a bunch of bands.
But yeah, it was a grunge movement that everybody thought it was cool.
So I hear these young people going, yell the Six. And I'm like, you do realize Toronto is like a tenth the size of New York. It doesn't have all this shit to do again. But, you know, that's the beauty of art. They can make anything sound sexy, attractive. I got to get there. I mean, Drake put Toronto on the map, but, you know, he needed cash money or whatever it was. It was a variation of cash money. It was Lil Wayne. It wasn't Baby exactly, but it wasn't Drake put on by Young Money with Nicki Minaj and all those guys.
And actually, Jay Prince, in his book, The Art of Science and Respect, shout out to Jay Prince, shout out to OG Spook, shout out to all our people down in Houston, Third Ward, Fifth Ward, Sunnyside, Acres Homes, South Acres. Jay Prince talks about that in his book, about how they initially came across Drake. But those that really want to know the whole story in depth, get the book. But I will get all this.
Yeah,
but he talked about how that whole situation, how they facilitated that meeting with they felt like he would be a better fit of Cash Money for what was going on at the time at Rap-A-Lot, and they thought Drake would be better over there, and that's how he ended up over Cash Money, / Young Money. Everybody kind of knows about what happened after that. We're not going to get into that. But like I said, read the book. It's worth the read. But Drake, to see where he started, it's funny. Shout out to my man Bezo, Brandon Turner. This is how far this goes back, because this is going back to like 2006 on MySpace. So this is like when Drake and them are like, he actually had communications with his people. He never got the interview with them, but this is like 2006, Drake, Doug, and King. This is like before Drake blows like 3 years later in 2009. So Drake is like still coming out of Toronto, still trying to get it out there. Him, Noah 40, Shabib, the whole crew. So like, he was just like a working artist during that time. But
yeah,
he just, it's the one thing about it, and you are just as much of a music savant as we are, Doug, because you have your own crazy legendary history with it. It's just about where the market is and how the music resonates and captures with the audience.
Yeah.
And
he found a formula where he could sing.
Yeah.
Now, a friend of mine told me it's not auto-tune, but they correct his vocals. Because I said to a buddy of mine, I said, you know, the thing about Drake is he's got great, you know, he obviously is a good lyricist, but he can sing. And, well,
right.
They got to correct his pitch. But I said, well, he found this niche where he's like, I'll make songs that girls like, I'll make songs that thugs like, I'll make songs. Like, he found this, you know, and Jack Harlow, I really liked Jack Harlow's first couple records, and then I heard First Class, I was like, well, he's just trying to be like Drake. Like, it's a formula now, right? It's a formula to be,
right,
appeal to this market and that market and this market. It's a little more calculating than the old school records to me. Right, like Biggie wasn't really trying to do, when he made Juicy, he wasn't really saying, you know, he just did what he wanted and it happened to catch on. Now they really probably are, you know, focus grouping. is this gonna appeal to our 14-year-old girls and our 16-year-old girls and our 19-year-old men? Like, I mean, it's a lot more of a business than it was,
yeah,
even 15 years ago, right? But yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
Drake is.
Yeah.
I knew him from Degrassi in the wheelchair, and when he came out talking, yeah, I'm like, he came out talking all this gangster sounding shit, and I was like, dude, come on. So my daughter, who's, you know, she's American, and my daughter kept saying, why does he keep saying he started from the bottom? He started on Degrassi. I'm like, I think he means he didn't have connections in the world. He's not trying to say he was the poorest guy in the world. He had a bar mitzvah in suburban Toronto. But I think he's saying, like, I didn't have all the connects to make it in the music industry. But nevertheless, we are where we are, man. I don't judge. Like, I look at what's out there. I mean, getting back to Ice-T. Ice-T got into some shit with Soulja Boy, and everybody knows. And when I asked him about it, I was
which
like,
is hilarious.
Yeah, it was hilarious. And he was like, man, I was just saying, this isn't lyrical the way, you know, so, you know, Superman, whatever the fucking song Soulja Boy had out. And it's just, you know, eras change, right? Eras do change.
Right.
And the fact is, it was much more lyrically based back in the mid-90s. Even, I mean, for me, like, people talking about 93, 94, I'm like, man, I fuck with the 1988. Because, like, I had the first time I heard Public Enemy, I heard, like, you know, I heard Rakim, but then I heard Joski Love doing Pee Wee's Dance. I heard Chub Rock doing Papa. Like, it was so mixed up. You could have crazy fun records and then also gangster records. It was such a diverse, you know, playing field. And plus, there were so many independent labels. So all these guys are putting out stuff. To me right now, it all sounds a lot more the same. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit more homogenized, right? Yeah. I mean, but that has to do with the money, right? People
well,
are going to change.
And, yeah, but that's what happened along the way. Because what we started seeing was, and what you said, Doug, is it's so spot on. Because back in the day when it was considered a fad, nobody really looked at hip-hop as being commercially viable. I mean, hell, they killed Hammer for doing, you know, cartoons, doing a KFC commercial, which I didn't think was being Sambo Buck Dancing. It was just they were selling a product. But it was the fact that what it was for that time, it was the element of what was considered hip-hop was still sacred to the street, which would be the premise for Ice Cube's True to the Game when he had that second verse. When you first start rhyming, you started off slow, and then you started climbing. but it wasn't fast enough, I guess. So you gave the other style a test. You was hardcore hip hop. Now look at yourself, boy. You done flip flop, giving my music away to the mainstream. Don't you know they ain't down with the team? You know, so it changed the whole trajectory because we saw it being now. It was making it into the commercial mainstream, which would also come in 1992 when Mainstream did Faking the Funk. You know, when Lars Professor said at the beginning, and I do realize now that hip-hop is a business. So,
exactly. Thank you for reminding me. Main Source, by the way, for anybody who's listening who doesn't know where
DJ
Nas K-Cut started.
DJ K-Cut was from Canada, too.
But Live at the Barbecue, I mean, that's what, I mean, I remember that. When we heard this kid, Nasty Nas, we're like, who the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, he was killing. Like, I mean, I was there. I'm not boasting and bragging. I'm just saying I was there. I was there when I heard, you know, I went to the New Music Seminar. It was 93. I met Suge Knight, and there was no East Coast, West Coast bullshit. 93, 92, I can't remember. Got his business card. It was made, like, on some Kinko's fucking photocopy shit. Like, it was just like, this is Death Row. Like, a guy. But Biggie was out front with his own, you know, like, you know, when, what is it called? When people go on strike, like a placard. Biggie, you know, they were just, who is B.I.G.? Because at that point, the one single they had out was Flavor in Your Ear by Craig Mack. And I'm going, okay, who's this new label Bad Boy? I mean, I knew who Puffy was because I used to go to all the parties. And there was a party called Puffy's, can't remember, at the Red Zone. And it was like, it was the place to go hear hip hop. And then he got fired from Uptown Records. Anyway, he did his own shit. But, like, all this stuff that you're talking about, like, Main Source comes out, and we're going, who's this kid now? Nas. Who's this kid? Biggie. Like, it was so interesting and entertaining at the time to just hear new voices and just to hear what they were doing and hear what, I mean, there wasn't all that commercialism. It wasn't all a business plan. Like, let me market this. Let me market the merchandise. Let me market the tour. Let me do this. Let me calculate this. It was a lot more Wild West. Let me put it that way. Wild West.
Well, it was about pulling your stick gun. Yeah. I mean, he was about pulling your stick gun. And, you know, it was literally.
Tricky.
Yeah. And you figure that was the beauty of it. I think that's why, especially us being older, we have such a fond nostalgia for it in terms of that generation, that iteration, the time of the music, because it was all about, it was more authentic. When we think about some of the songs that came out during those eras, like between 88 and 99, I mean, Willie D's Gangster of Love. I mean, could you imagine if that dropped today?
I'm telling you about those gangster dudes in Brooklyn, like, right? I'm telling you about, and I'm driving around with this guy. So Supreme, Life, there's another guy, Justice. Justice and I are driving around, and he just keeps blasting this song by Scarface. It's going down. And it's just about, you know, a guy picking up another guy's girl. He said, this is the most gangster shit I've ever heard. And it wasn't gay. It was just like, oh, you know, go on. If my homies caught me slipping, they'd do the same to me. And it was like, and so I'm going to tell you, this is real New York gangster G's. Like, this guy had a fucking manslaughter conviction. Like, this is the most gangster fucking record I've ever heard. But it was just the way he was talking. It had nothing to do. It wasn't violent. I mean, the more rah, rah, blam, blam, blam shit you hear in records, the more I actually think it's not gangster. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, Ice-T's, I'm thinking of his catalog as far as gangster shit. Like, when he does High Rollers. So, getting back to our book, which we were going to talk about. I mean, Spike, in the video for High Rollers, which is going back quite a ways now.
He's really holding the tool.
Yeah, he's got an Uzi. And the police were looking for a robbery that happened in Santa Barbara where if you want to read the book, three of the Harlem Globetrotters were falsely arrested. Before they used the phrase racial profiling, Spike's about 5'10". His cousin is 5'6 at the time because he's like 12 years old. and they end up throwing three of the Harlem Globetrotters a day later, one of whom is 6'11", the other 6'10". It's like, what? The only thing they had in common was the color of their skin. So, and they went on Donahue and whatever. But, yeah, that same robbery that wasn't solved, they ended up solving it in part because of High Rollers video. And Spike is, like, in it very briefly, walking across with an Uzi. And I was talking to Ice's manager, and I said, you know, so Ice has this line in one of his later records where he says, best believe the gas in my promo shots ain't props. And I said, yeah, so he had, you know, it was all their real girls, like Darlene, and it was all their real cars. Yeah. And I was talking to Ice's manager. I said, yeah, man, so Ice was so authentic. He goes, Doug, it wasn't authentic. Like, why would we – it costs money. You're making a video. Why would – this is George. George and Oso was the nicest manager from 40 years ago. Why would we rent a mansion? Why would we rent cars? Why would we rent guns when we had them? Like, all these guys had them. It had nothing to do with, like, keeping it real. And Ice has the best line ever when he says, I was so naive. I didn't know you could lie. Like, he goes, if you look at the cover of Ryan Page – to this day, look at the cover of Ryan Page. So that's Evil E. That's Henge. Ice's Porsche. Yeah. Henji. It's Henji. It's Darlene, his girl, wearing his pendant, which is a very famous. It's a gun. It's Ice in his own Porsche. And he goes, I didn't know you could just rent shit for a video. Like, that wasn't cool where I came from. Now it's like everybody got models in their video. You know, the video vixen phenomenon. Like, later on, I wrote this for we're talking about magazines. King magazine, remember King? There were a bunch of these magazines, I did this thing, man. I was writing about another Toronto girl, Melissa Ford and Gloria Velez, and all. I was like, yeah, there's this whole like genre now of these video vixens. Well, yeah, but in Ice's day, you just had your real girlfriend. If she was a dime, she was a dime. That's it. Like, you didn't pretend to be something you weren't. That all kind of went out the window after, after a few people proved you didn't have to be what you said you were. But I'm old enough to remember, I wasn't there. I'm not going to lie. I wasn't there. But I remember when poor PM Don, that big fat guy, PM Don. KRS-One.
KRS. Yeah, ran up.
He just came on and grabbed the mic. This isn't hip-hop. But he wasn't trying to be hip-hop. Like, he was just trying to be, like, a pop artist, whatever. KRS was trying to be the gatekeeper of all of what the true hip-hop was. And I think after that, I think he probably realized. But, I mean, those New York guys were trying to do that for a while, like with Hammer. I mean, you had Third Base, and I used to laugh and go, you know, Prime Minister Pete Nice. He's a Columbia University student. You got Tretch. Search. I'm like, and you're telling Hammer, whose brother is a big drug dealer in fucking Oakland, like you're telling him
Lewis
he's not
Burrow. Lewis Burrow. Like, no, man. Look. That was it's funny because we got to. Oh man, because there's so many points we wanted to hit on with that. But going back to the thing with Hammer, that's why. And of course. A lot of heads, the one thing about it, shout out to our heads out in Oakland, of course, CMG from Conscious Daughters, Big Uncle Richie Rich, Yuck Mouth, all of our people out in Oakland, man. And the Bay, San Francisco in general, of course, Black Sea.
Berkeley.
I mean,
Spice
One.
The whole Bay Area has got, they've got a deep culture in the Bay Area,
and they're serious about the street game. Ain't no punks coming out the Bay Area. Oakland, San Francisco, Vallejo, none of that. None of them, no, there ain't no punks come out of there. And and Redman, you know, when he dissed, Hammer on his skit on his debut album, and, you know, him and Hammer had a little discussion about it, and Red was like, then I realized, like, I shouldn't have said that, which Red was saying was fun, but it was like, but then he found out, like, you know, they serious out there, you know, and that town, as they call it, the town, you get put down if you're talking down on the town.
You gotta remember, in New York City, we had Video Music Box, you know, Ralph McDaniel.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, even, like, Soul Train, which I used to watch every Saturday morning for the hot girls and all that, they didn't, you know, Don Cornelius didn't really like hip-hop, I think. But he would have Hammerhead, you know, Turn This Mother Out. Like, he was making more dance records, making it a little bit more accessible. Yeah, it wasn't that hard lyrical stuff that New York was. I mean, okay, I understand being a little bit more angry at Vanilla Ice, who just stole a Black fraternity chant and then popularized some shit. But Hammer was just doing, like, party music, and he was dancing, like, come on, man. I mean, that whole thing with Third Base would be white guys, and they were like, you know, man, we're going to, you know, Pop Goes the Weasel. I was watching it all, and I was kind of going, you know, this is a little weird. Two white guys and a black DJ, and you're basically saying, this guy from, you know, he's not real? Like, huh. Anyway, thank God that it's actually opened up a little bit more where, I mean, you know, if you got skills, you got skills. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Jack Harlow. I'm not crazy about him. But when I first heard Eminem, I mean, his voice gets annoying to me, but I said, nobody can say Eminem can't rhyme. The guy can write whatever the fuck he wants to write, you know? And there have been white MCs. There's been Chinese MCs. There will be – every culture will produce great MCs at this point because it has to do with talent, not ethnicity. It has nothing to do with –
but you got to remember, too. But, Doug, you got to remember, too, you mentioned Everlast, and he was part of Rhyme Syndicate when Ice-T first started.
Yep. Yep.
You know, so that was in your book.
Should I tell that? So real quick, so what happened was Ice was trying to put together the best West Coast MCs. So Dub C, like the best guys. So the Donald D, there's well-known guys from this world. Dub C is probably one of the better known. But Everlast and Ice told me, like, he was just trying to be talent development. And he said, I hear this guy, what was his name? Bashir. He brings him Everlast, and he says, man, you're great, but you just sound like Rakim. You're doing Rakim. Like, you be yourself. And then Everlast kind of found his own voice. By the way, so in our book, so Spike is – the very first Everlast video was called Syndication.
The Rhythm. Oh, Syndication. I thought it was The Rhythm. Okay.
Well, the video is called Syndication.
Okay.
And there's – you see Spike with his own Trans – again, his own Trans Am, his Miami Dolphins gear. But, yeah, Everlast never really found his voice until he left the syndicate world. And, you know, Tommy Boy kind of rebranded him as, wait, you're white, you're Irish. Okay, wear the Celtics jerseys. Let's do House of Pain. You know,
they know how to
They found the marketing. Yep, exactly. Because he kind of looked, if you look back at the first Everlast video, it looked like Color Me Bad or something like that, right? Like these white boys. Yes, good looking. They got their nice hair.
Head on the suit and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, but those were the days.
But Ice was trying to put
together.
I just want to say, so with Syndication, so with the Rhyme Syndicate, people don't know the whole story. Ice, there really wasn't a West Coast scene. There was, like you said, King T. There was another guy named Toddy T. Ice said, let me put together the best talent I can find on the West. And we'll just have, like, a click, the Rhyme Syndicate. And he was just trying to bring the best people up that he could. And I think Ice has always been about that, you know, a rising tide raises all boats, right? Like, if you just hog everything to yourself. So I think he was a really good encourager of a lot of guys who had talent and this, you know. But one of the things I really learned writing this book was that I said to me, Doug, to go from what I was doing in the streets, everybody's a boss when they're a gangster, they're an armed robber, whatever, to go and, you know, music's a little easier because you still live in that lifestyle where you're up till 4 in the morning. But you go to work on New Jack City or, you know, Law and Order, you got to be up at 5 in the morning, listen to somebody tell you what to do. He said, a lot of my friends couldn't do that. They couldn't make that transition to just, like, sucking it up and doing, like, you're well paid for it. But, you know, it's not the same thing as being a street gangster. Like going to work on a movie, you're being told what to do. You're being told what time to get up. A lot of people can't make that transition. And so when he rehabilitates Spike, like at the end there of the book, Spike comes home and, I mean, fucking 35 to life, right? That's a serious sentence. And I almost put him to a...
That whole
and you remember, somebody said this to me. I didn't make this up. He goes, it's almost like Ice put him through a second parole hearing. Like Ice wanted to make sure, you know, first of all, Spike, are you done? Are you done breaking the law? Second of all, is your ego in check? Third of all, can we fit you into the team here? So, yeah, I mean, the idea, a lot of people say this, like Jay-Z's made a fortune, 50 Cent has made a fortune. But a lot of people read about these street gangsters and they say, you know, Spike was, for example, using white privilege way back before anybody uses that term. Like he was realizing that there were jewelry stores in Beverly Hills where a person of color could never gain entrance. So he goes and gets a guy on Skid Row who's a white guy, who's a heroin junkie, take him to Supercuts, give him a little Robert De Niro haircut, as he said, goes and takes Dickies that are brown, just like the UPS uniforms, and makes up a fake UPS uniform. And he goes, the only people getting into these stores in Rodeo Drive are like messengers from UPS and FedEx. So he takes a guy on Skid Row who just happens to be white. He goes, Doug, I was utilizing white privilege. And I was like, damn, man, that's fucking genius. And I said that to ICE's manager, George, and I said, you know what? People often say these street guys would be like billionaires if they just applied this ingenuity. And ICE's manager said, you know what, Doug? I've been around all these street guys. It's easy to say that. You know, this guy was so creative with his street hustle. But you got to remember, it's a different thing to make it in corporate America. You got to suck up a lot of bullshit, take a lot of insults, be patient. Deferred gratification. Mm. Not all these street guys can do that. So it's a very simple thing. Yeah. A lot of people look at these street guys and go, what, that was brilliant, that bank robbery, the way they planned that job. Now, if they only used that, they would be the biggest, like, you know, Fortune 500. Yeah, not necessarily. They'd also have to learn how to be patient. Maybe your payoff will come a year from now, not next week, right? Most gangsters I know, by the way, they can't wait. Like, they need it now. That's the biggest problem. They need that paper now.
Yeah.
They need it now, and if you tell them you'll get the payoff in a year, they tell you, a fucking year? What the fuck are you talking about? I don't know if I'm gonna be alive in a year.
The patience ain't there.
Well, if you're from a certain neighborhood, and you guys know this better than I do, you don't know if you're 24. Are you going to make it to 25?
That's true.
You don't know.
That's true.
Exactly.
You don't know. I mean, MC8, I mean, another guy, Coolio died. I love Gangsta's Paradise. MC8, straight up menace. And he goes, I'm 23 now. Will I live to be 24? Like, he doesn't know. And that's the fucking mentality a lot of people probably have, which is give it to me now because I don't know if I'm going to be a – don't tell me I'm going to make my money when I'm 40. I don't expect to live to be 40, right?
But that's the avarice in the human nature of appetite because we want that quick gratification of the gluttony, you know, and we want it now. We see it. We feel it's once we get a taste of, and it's not even getting a taste of when it's actually in our palate. It's the taste of what we think it's going to taste like once we get it. And that drives people.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's how people get driven to that. And of course, shout out to George Hinojosa, ICE's manager that you were speaking of. First time, because George actually have him on my Facebook. First time I knew about George was when he actually helped produce the Iceberg Slim documentary that was on Showtime.
Oh yeah, no, he directed.
Yeah,
he directed.
Yeah, he directed it. That's how I became aware of George. George, if you're listening, dude, that documentary was everything. Thank you for giving us that history. You and I both. That was an unbelievable film.
Ice was so influenced by Iceberg Slim. And then he tells me, watch the documentary me and George made. And I was like, I mean, there's a twist, you know, plot spoiler here. he didn't write all the books. His wife, his wife wrote a bunch of them. Like, there's some crazy shit in that guy's life. I mean, he was a real pimp. But, yeah, like I said, he documented it. He decided, I'm going to tell, and if you read that first book, Pimp, you cannot read Pimp by Iceberg Slim and say he's glamorizing that world. It is a scary, so, you know, when Ice said this several times in the book and my first book I did with him, I always patted myself on Iceberg Slim, meaning he shows you the A side and the B side of the game. There's a dark side. There's always a downfall. So if you listen to Ice's records, High Rollers, all of his New Jack Hustler, it never ends well. Like, these guys are always, there's a downfall. So the reality is Ice committed what he told me, thousands of felonies. He said, Doug, it was perpetual crime. He said, it wasn't like you wake up. He said, when I said I was a career criminal, I meant that was my career. It was 5-6 felonies a day. You'd have a plan to hit a lick at a jewelry store. So you meet up, you're with these girls. First you got to hit a G-ride, you got to steal a car. So that's the second felony. But then the girls see a chance to go into the cash register with a nail file. Third felony. He goes, it was 4-5-6. And Ice goes, I got a pass. Like, all his friends were going away doing. Spike did a 3-5 at first. Then he got the 35 to life. So all of Ice's friends were going away. And he was like, they were all saying, you know, dude, player, don't come up in here, man. In the California prison system, you know, motherfuckers don't know nothing about, like, Dom Perignon and Lobster up here. This is like, you put your rag on your head, you're blue, you're a grip or your blood, and you're fighting the Mexicans. And I said that actually sobered him up to be like, you know, I think Ice told me he went broke for 2 years. He lost money from being a player, hustler, stealing, to go into hip hop because he said, you know, the New York rappers, I think it was Africa Islam and God, what a great rapper from Cold Crush. I'm blanking out. Who's the great greatest MC from Cold Crush Brothers?
I know you're talking about.
I'll think of it in a second. He's on the case lay, you know, rolling 50 deep, rolling 100 deep. I'll think of it in a sec. Anyway, they tell Ice, why are you trying to do this, man? Like, none of us have bought a car. You got a Porsche. You got jewelry. They're all, he goes, yeah, but I'm trying to transition. I don't want to be in this life. It's got a fucking short life expectancy being in the streets here, man. So the New York rappers are all kind of like.
Grandmaster Kaz. Yeah. I keep thinking of Grandmaster Kaz.
Kaz. Thank you, Kaz. I was going to say, the guy who Big Bang Hank stole his fucking lyrics. He referenced the life. But
that was,
yeah,
sick.
Ice was always really clear to me. He was very clear saying, I never wanted to glamorize this street shit because my whole message in every one of my street raps, if it's a reality rap, is that there's a downfall. And he said, I patterned that on Iceberg Slim. Like, he doesn't make it sound like pimping is this wonderful, you know, at the end of the day, it's not a happy ending. There's no happy endings in that life, any kind of gangster life, unless you figure out a way, like Jay-Z, 50 Cent, maybe Dre wasn't that much of it. Get out, take your legit money, take your illegit money and turn it into legit money and become part of corporate America or whatever the fuck it is, pay your taxes and all that. But if you think you're going to be a high profile, getting back to what you said about John Dillinger, if you think you're going to be a high-profile gangster, it didn't end well for Al Capone, John Gotti. You cannot be a gangster who's well-known. And I'm going to quote Ice-T again.
No.
Ice-T got busted. It's one of the best. It's a very short episode in this book, but we made it. It was a whole chapter in our first book where Ryan Pace is already out, and he already has a video on MTV. And he has a Porsche, but there's a part missing from something broke in his convertible mechanism. So the hustler's mentality is, why would I go pay for this shit? Let's just steal it. So he asked his boys, you know. So his friends have already stolen the fucking, they've stolen the Porsche, and he's getting impatient. He's going, where the fuck is the Porsche? Like, you said you got the part for me. So he says, fuck it, I'll go just take it myself. So he takes his ratchet, And they've stolen the Porsche and parked it somewhere under a tarp in a complex where people are living. So Ice goes in. Now, again, it's 87, so he already has a record out. And apparently people know him from his album cover and from videos. He says he's got his ratchet out of his waist. He's pulling the tarp off, and he hears screaming. Ah, ah. He's thinking, oh, fuck, I'm busted. And then he realizes it's kids running towards him with record albums that they want signed. And then their parents are running, and he goes, oh, fuck, I'm too famous to see. Like, shit. Like, I can't do this. And then Ice actually speaks like a philosopher a lot of the time, and he says to me, Doug, infamy and fame do not go together. The only thing that the criminal has over the cops is his anonymity. I mean, you got aliases. You don't carry your real driver's license. You're a criminal. You can vanish into the shadows. Once you're known, you cannot be. He said there is no such thing as a high-profile criminal, except for maybe Donald Trump or a couple other people, right? But
that's
a lot of my belief. But Ice told me the minute he realized he couldn't steal anymore, he goes, that's when I realized I got to get the fuck out of it. He holds this big meeting with all these guys like Spike, and he goes, Doug, he tells me, Spike, all these guys, you know what? I don't know what you're doing. I'm not going to judge you guys. I think they had a nightclub in L.A. And he goes, I'm not going to judge you guys. You guys can work security here. I can't tell you what to do, but treat me like I'm bugged. Treat me like I am a fucking recording microphone, because I think I'm under scrutiny. Don't tell me anything you are doing, because I don't want to be the reason any of you guys get arrested. So he realized pretty quickly that you can't be high profile. So, yeah, John Gotti, Al Capone. John Gotti loved being on the cover of Time magazine. He had it in the social club on Mulberry Street. Like, guess what?
He had a Raven Eye. Raven Eye Social Club, yeah.
Yeah. So if you think about the idea that some of these guys portray now in hip-hop, that they are gangsters, they're killers, they're this, I'm a blood. If anybody gets the audiobook of our Split Decision, at the very end there's about an hour and 20 minutes where I'm talking to Ice and Spike. And it was shit we didn't put in the book. And I said something about God knows what. And I said, yeah, Spike, explain gang enhancement charges. So these are charges in California State Prison. It may be also in the correctional system in other jurisdictions. But Spike explained, if they can prove you're a blood, a Crip, Latin King, whatever it is, you might get an added 10 years added to your sentence. So I was kind of explaining to all you young rappers out there, just claiming you're a blood, claiming you're a Crip, I mean, just saying this shit, it's not to your advantage. If you get busted doing something stupid, you got another 10 years of gang enhancement. So he's trying to spit some game, but, you know, I don't know that anybody younger than 30 wants to hear an older person saying anything.
But, I mean...
Somebody asked me... I'll let you finish, but, I mean, somebody asked me if this book would, like, affect young people, and I was like, dude, I know what it was to be 17, 18, 19. Like, I didn't want to hear what any older person told me what to do. Like, I thought, I'm smarter than you. I'll get away with it, right? So, you know, but... The glamorization of it, I mean, the fact that there are people, I mean, a great artist. I love Nipsey Hussle. I really thought he was great. And I was asking Ice about that. I said, well, wait, Nipsey was 60s. He's wearing the Seattle Mariners cap. He goes, Doug, when I came out, you couldn't do that. Before the truce in 92, there was a big peace, you know, there was a peace truce between the Bloods and the Crips. Everybody sat down. He said, when I first came out, it was shoot on sight. You couldn't claim a neighborhood, because if I claimed to be Rolling 60s or Harlem Crips, I'd make enemies of like 99% of the other guys in L.A. So it didn't make business sense. It didn't make personal safety sense. Because I was like, well, how is Nipsey like wearing the – because, yeah, because it's okay now. Like, now people do it. People claim their neighborhood. But when we first came out, it wasn't done. At least – I mean, Snoop came out wearing blue – but I think that was after the peace treaty. It wasn't done pre the Rodney King riots. It wasn't done.
And we got a little time left, but we're gonna make it quick. But yeah, but I mean, but when you look at certain albums like what Compton's Most Wanted, when you had the blue cassette, you know, you kinda knew what was up. If you were from California and you saw hints of it with certain colors on the records or what they wore, you knew what it was. And shout out to Rashidi Harper and Ed from Hip Hop Uncovered, because Ice-T was, like you said, Doug, was spitting the same sentiments when he was telling all of his people, you know, what he was doing in his part of the interview in that series. He was talking about how I was running down that cliff, but then I stopped, and then I'm running back telling everybody, don't go that way, don't go off that cliff.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, oh, my God. And, Doug, we – dude, this has been phenomenal. We got to have you back for a part two, because there's so much more we have not talked about.
We didn't even cover shit. Well, I got to be honest with you, man. I've been sitting there drinking beer, so maybe I've been rambling too much. But, yeah, if there's other stuff you want to ask, I mean.
You have not. Hey, this has been great. Hey, this has been great.
King didn't even get a word in edgewise, though, man. Like, what the fuck? I mean, been doing it.
Hey, man, I was just sitting there. Hey, sometimes I just shut up and let you off.
Doug, this has been fantastic. Welcome back.
Yo.
We got to do a part two of this. We got to do a part two, and soon. Because we don't want
Baltimore anytime, man.
To
we
cut
didn't.
Us off.
We didn't really. Yeah, we didn't get into the nuts and bolts of the. But I mean, we talked about. I mean, this is a subject that I really think more young people need to hear about. Is like, hip hop isn't what you think it is. Just here in the, you know, post 2018. You know, hip-hop was something in the 80s. Hip-hop was something in the 70s. Hip-hop was something in the 90s.
Exactly.
The thing that I'm very impressed by, though, is I meet 20-year-olds, 21, 25, that love hip-hop, and they say, oh, man, did it ever get better than Biggie and Pac? And I'm like, well, thank God you at least can recognize that that shit was great, you know? I mean, the young people that really understand what lyricism is or what good production is. And I was blessed, man, because when Dre's record came out, you know, I was listening to DJ Premier was the greatest, you know, New York producer I ever heard. I mean, he was making these incredible layered beats. And then Dre came out with, you know, The Chronic, the first one. We were like, what? And there was these, such a difference in sound, right? So to have lived through that stuff and to be, you know, man, I feel blessed because it was a really special moment.
Dude, and this is a special moment. Yeah. This is a special and a blessed moment, you being with us. And, I mean, we're all blessed for that era we came up in. Man. Doug, tell everybody where to find you online. Tell everybody about your books. We're going to have you back on the show. You just say when and we'll have you, because we still got to do a part two about the books and everything, because you wrote about El Chapo and Lester Holt.
Oh, yeah.
Special on that.
Yeah, man.
So
we
got to have you back about that one.
The Narcos, yeah, man. Well, you got to remember, I'm in my 50s now, so, man, I've covered the waterfront. I got the Italian mafia, the Russian mafia. Yeah, I've gotten to know. But you know what? There's a similarity to all these guys. You can go to DouglasCentury.com, so it's D-O-U-G-L-A-S Century, just like DonDeDeus.com. You can go to HarperCollins if you look up The Last Boss of Brighton. This book that we've been talking about with Ice and Spike is Simon & Schuster, and just look up Split Decision, Ice-T. Been great. You know, we got great reviews. I'm just hoping more young people. And the thing about Ice is he's iconic now, right? But more people know him from Law & Order. He spent more time as Detective Finn on Law & Order than he has as a hip-hop artist. But, you know, Ice is very he's very realistic. And he'll tell me, Doug, I could tour till I'm 70, you know, with my heavy metal band, the body count, right? But hip-hop, man, you got a life expectancy in hip-hop. It's very short, you know, because young people – they want the young shit, and I'm sure they listen to Tretch and Chuck D and say they sound old. They don't sound old to me, but to younger people, they might.
As long as they got the production behind them, they gonna. Hey, they can still hang with the best of them. As long as they get the dope production behind them, that's all they need.
Well, you know, DJ Clay, you know, K-Clay, rest in peace. He did that Rolling 50 Deep, Rolling 100 Deep. He put all these dudes on there, and Melly Mel, I mean, all these guys can still fucking, they can rock the beat with anybody, you know. But lyricism in hip-hop, it's something I could talk about forever, because to me, it's kept poetry alive. I think it's if I had a second career as an English teacher, I would just teach hip-hop. And then I would say, okay, through hip-hop, you can learn Shakespeare. You can learn all the other shit you need to know for your college entrance exams. But, I mean, all the poetic devices, rappers are doing all that stuff. I mean, hip-hop MCs, these guys are writing stories. They're writing metaphorically. They're using such complex poetic devices that, I mean, I'm pretty sure Ivy League universities are teaching some hip-hop now, but they should be teaching, you know, all of it, because it is the new literature. For me, it's as good as any literature out there, the best of it, not the shitty shit, not the garbage.
Exactly. Man.
So whenever you guys want to have me back. So, yeah, anybody look up Split Decision by Ice-T Spike, who is Ice-T's partner in crime, literal partner in crime, and myself, Douglas Entry, if you want to check out my website or my Amazon page. And, guys, anytime you want to have me back and we talk more shit, whatever conversation you guys want to have.
Let's get it. Doug, you know I'm a bookworm, so you know I'm going to be digging to get the rest of your books as well.
Take them out from the library. Yeah. Like my mom's an elderly Jewish lady, and like all her friends, I took your son's book out of the library. I'm like, well, thanks a lot. I made no royalties on that sale, but like, take it out of the library. If you want, I always tell people, if you find it in your local like library, yeah, man, just read it. I don't give a shit. But yeah, I appreciate it, man. Like, it's rare for me to find conversations these days where we can really talk about the depth of this culture and the art form. You know, because a lot of the younger people just don't care.
Yeah, because a lot of they're not really culturally based.
Yeah.
You're right.
They're not vested in it. They're not vested in it as they should be in terms of really understanding the history and what it entails. But this is why having you on the show, Doug, this was monumental. Me and King were just super excited of a man of your stature, pedigree, humility, intelligence, generosity, courtesy, and benevolency to give us your time. We can't say enough.
Brother,
we've appreciated this.
I'm literally on a deadline to finish something, and I'm kind of procrastinating, and I would rather sit and sip a few beers and talk to you guys. So it's been so much fun for me.
Definitely.
I hope I was semi-rational and semi-coherent.
No, you were fully coherent. And we got to make sure you get that paycheck, so go ahead and beat that deadline. Doug, we're about to close shop for the night. Once again, thank you so much. You know we're going to be in touch with you outside of this as well on the regular, just to make sure you're good. Give, you know, our best to your mother, your daughter, your whole family. Shout out to Canada,
thanks,
great white north. We appreciate you so much. Thank you again.
Thank you guys for having me on, man. Peace out, man. Enjoy your weekend, everybody, okay? Be safe.
Yes, sir.
I'll enjoy, man.
Peace. King, take us out of here.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, on that note, we up out of here. Catch us next time, same time, same channel. Holla.